It's the morning show. I'm Shereen Seewert. Canadian utility company Enbridge has been mired in litigation for years surrounding its Line 5 pipeline. In the most recent development, a federal judge ruled in favor of the Bad River Band of Lake Superior Chippewa, ordering the company to shift Line 5 off of tribal lands. You can join in this discussion at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Mike Wiggins Jr. is chairman of the Bad River Band of Lake Superior Chippewa. Mike, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Yeah, thank you. I'm honored to be here.
A major federal ruling has passed since you joined the show earlier this month. U.S. District Judge William Conley ordered Enbridge to remove its Line 5 pipeline from Bad River Reservation land. So now Enbridge has 3 years to reroute the line. What's really at the heart of this issue for you?
Well, water protection of our water resources, what's at stake and at issue for us in Bad River is the potential toxifying of downstream surface waters. In this particular instance, it's at the meander, which is in the Bad River itself. And then ultimately the threat to our tribal nation's drinking water realm, our groundwater aquifers. And then even in your summary statement, to turn the question over, you talked about the reroute. There's some fantasy or some magical thinking about the notion that Enbridge's reroute is a done deal or that it's just going to happen. They are in an incredibly sensitive environmental area that's tied directly to our groundwater aquifers in Bad River, and we're going to have an issue with that reroute.
Did you expect this ruling from Judge Conley?
To a certain extent, we were definitely pleased to see him uphold the trespass, essentially that Enbridge doesn't have a legal right to operate, and that was a stressful proposition going into court. I mean, Enbridge's position at one time was that they have eminent domain rights and they could just take our land and water. Or whatever they need in order to perpetuate their oil flow. And so the court sounded out the truth for us and that our sovereign authority is intact and Enbridge's ability to be there legally is their time is up.
Mike, your attorney, Eric Arnold, released a statement that said that the court's three-year timeline for Enbridge to vacate the lands, quote, leaves the Bad River vulnerable to catastrophe, end quote. Do you think 3 years is too long to wait if this actually goes forward?
Well, absolutely. In this past spring, we saw the river was about 21 feet away from the pipe. And during the spring melt, in a span of less than a week, we lost over half that earth between the river and the pipe at that particular spot. So right now the river is only about 10 feet away from the pipe and it's working at that bank every day. So every flood scenario, every thunderstorm and big storm coming in is a cause for stress because that area is about to give way. And so the notion that Enbridge has 3 years or that we have any time at all is really, again, a bit of conjecture that isn't rooted in reality. What's going to happen is that the meander is going to fail. It's going to fail during a high water flood event, thunderstorm, or maybe some type of melt off due to snow. But ultimately, right now, as far as timelines go, the Bad River itself, the Bad River proper, is in charge of all the schedules and all the timelines because it's going to pound open the meander and ultimately most likely rupture the pipe.
We're talking about Enbridge Line 5 with Mike Wiggins, chairman of the Bad River Band. We also have the executive director of Midwest Environmental Advocates Nonprofit Law Center, Tony Wilkin-Gibbert, with us today. Tony, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hi, Shereen. Thank you for having me.
Tony, Judge Conley's order is pretty clear that Enbridge must implement its December 2022 monitoring and shutdown plan in full. So can you explain the key points of Enbridge's 2022 proposal for us?
Sure. Well, as Chairman Wiggins was just talking about, there is a stretch of the pipeline that is extremely close to the particular meander of the Bad River. And as Chairman Wiggins said, at this point, the pipeline is buried just 10 feet from where the river is eroding the riverbank. And that amount of space has actually decreased significantly in just this spring. Earlier in the year, it was at 26 feet. So there's a significant risk at the next flooding event that erosion could occur even more. And it's possible, I think even Enbridge concedes that a significant storm or flooding event could expose the pipeline, just a single event. And if the pipeline is exposed and then the river continues to erode underneath the pipeline could become unsupported, creating a very, very significant risk that it could rupture, resulting in a catastrophic spill. So as part of the band's lawsuit, the judge ordered Enbridge to put in place a plan to shut down the pipeline if and when further erosion occurs, and set specific kind of markers for if there are flood events of a certain magnitude, certain steps have to be taken. But there's real concern, and I think the chairman is correct here, that the Bad River is in charge, because in these kinds of weather events, you know, is it practical that Enbridge would be able to shut down the line in time? It would require a massive operation, getting equipment in place, getting workers situated. They would have to secure gas to actually purge the pipeline. And so, the judge did require Enbridge to do more than it was proposing to prevent that kind of catastrophic spill, but there are still significant concerns that that would be enough if and when the pipeline becomes exposed.
Mike, are you concerned about environmental risks to tribal lands during the relocation process if Line 5 does move?
Well, absolutely. I mean, the draft environmental impact statement that we saw, in a public comment session with the DNR had Enbridge blasting their way through 139 streams, creeks, river, wetland settings to try to seat their oil pipe in the ground and in bedrock. When you look at a USGS groundwater mapping, their reroute is in an incredibly sensitive area of the watershed where surface waters and groundwaters interact. Ultimately, some of those waters return back down into the drinking water aquifers of the Bad River Tribal Nation. And so the reroute, as it's proposed, is problematic. And it's more than problematic. It's actually a bit of a bit of a genocidal act, in the sense that Enbridge has no problem with our tribal people drinking oil-contaminated drinking water. And so so we're going to, there's a lot of environmental issues that are at stake there. The blasting itself at 139 spots has a cumulative impact at a place that I always refer to as the singularity. All points, high hills roll down into Bad River and come together right by U.S. Highway 2 and Bad River at a place called the White River and Bad River Confluence. And so everything comes together from the upper watershed. So there's a cumulative impact that we're going to endure right in the heart of Bad River from all of the activities on a panoramic kind of 360 from Enbridge blasting and oil toxicity and coal tar placement and all that other stuff. So, we're definitely concerned about environmental impacts.
You're hearing Mike Wiggins, chairman of the Bad River Band, and Tony Wilkin-Gibbert, director of Midwest Environmental Advocates. I will point out that Tony and MEA do not represent the Bad River Band, but we are happy to have both guests with us today. You can call in to 800-642-1234. I'm Shereen Seward. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Shereen Seward. What's next for Wisconsin and Line 5 after a federal judge's decision earlier this month? What do you want to see happen? Call 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Mike Wiggins Jr., chairman of the Bad River Band, and Tony Wilkin Gibbert, director of Midwest Environmental Advocates, stay with us. Tony, a few moments ago, we heard Mike talk about his concerns about the proposed reroute. What are some of your concerns about the environmental risks involved in this?
Yeah, thank you. We share all of those concerns. As Chairman Wiggins said, this is an area of immense ecological complexity. It's a pristine environment. And the notion that Enbridge could safely cross over 200 water bodies using, construction techniques such as blasting and horizontal directional drilling without impairing water quality. Is something that we are very, very concerned about. We saw in Line 3 construction in Minnesota that these kinds of construction techniques did contaminate water bodies there, and that is still a concern. So we are working to ensure that DNR's review of all of Enbridge's plans for this construction are scrutinized rigorously and that they meet the highest standards that are required. There's the idea that that this reroute can happen within the 3 years that the judge allowed the line to continue to operate on the reservation. But for almost that amount of time, Enbridge has submitted inadequate and insufficient information as part of the permitting process for this reroute. In fact, back in 2020, when it submitted information, it didn't include field surveys for close to a third of the water crossings that are involved here. And in many instances, its pictures, its field surveys didn't even match the proposed reroute. So it has been really dragging its heels and not providing adequate information that could allow the state to even assess the environmental impact and legally issue permits. So I think it's a real question whether it could complete that permitting process, let alone construction, within the amount of time that is left.
Mike, Greg from Reedsburg called. Greg wants to know what the Bad River empties into and what the consequences of a spill might be for that body. Is it Lake Superior?
Yeah, that would be Lake Superior, about 8-9 miles as the crow flies from the Enbridge pipe and the Bad River failure site. Downstream, about 8-9 miles, is the Bad River empties into Lake Superior. But a side note is that there's an unbelievable wetlands estuary, wild rice zone called the Cacogans Bad River Wetlands that have been designated ultimately as a Ramsar site, wetlands of worldwide importance. You have 47%, but over 40% of the wetlands of Lake Superior are sitting there power packed into that particular place. And so the Bad River downstream of the Enbridge pipe flows through those powerful wetlands and estuaries and then out into Lake Superior. Once you get into the big lake, you're sitting there staring right at the Apostle Islands National Lakeshore, ultimately the powerhouse of the sportsmen and commercial fishing realms of Big Lake Fish.
How old is Line 5? Tony, this is not a new line.
Absolutely not. The line was built in 1953. It is on the reservation of the Bad River Band because the U.S. government provided easements to Enbridge back in 1953. It was built with a 50-year lifespan in mind, we are now on year 70. And 10 of those 70 years, the pipeline has been placed on the Bad River Band's reservation illegally because the easements have been expired for over a decade now. So there's a real concern with leaks Even if the reroute were somehow completed and there was new pipeline around that 40-mile stretch, the rest of the pipeline is aging. The pipeline has leaked over 1 million gallons of oil over the course of its time operating in that area. So this is an aging pipeline, and Enbridge is really trying to just squeeze all of the life and the profits that it can out of a piece of aging, dirty fossil fuel infrastructure.
We're talking about the court-ordered reroute of Line 5 with Mike Wiggins, chairman of the Bad River Band, and Tony Wilkin-Gibbert, director of Midwest Environmental Advocates. Mike, do you think this federal ruling is strong enough to keep corporations like Enbridge from trespassing again?
Well, no, the court ruling itself. I mean, we had the trespassing upheld again, which makes Enbridge's presence on our reservation and in our lands and water illegal. But the remedy and the penalty as far as damages or for the trespass and all of that was, I believe, out of the court case was $5.1 million. $5.1 million for trespassing all that time at a scale to what Enbridge is worth as a international multi-billion-dollar conglomerate. $5.1 million is hardly a deterrent or even getting at the notion of restitution. Typically, you know, those types of penalties have make a perpetrator pause and think about their actions. In this case, it amounts to pennies for Enbridge. And so they're probably conjuring up how little it'll cost to just continue to try and trespass. And ultimately, you know, on our side of the coin here in Bad River, we got to think about that. There wasn't really a deterrent or a penalization for them profiting and profiteering on the backs of our river.
We've got a couple of minutes left in our time together. Tony, what happens next in the legal process? Enbridge is appealing. So what can we expect?
Certainly there will be appeals in the federal court system about Judge Conley's decision with the 3-year timeline, the ruling on trespass. In addition, there's a separate legal process involving the proposed reroute. So the state of Wisconsin and the federal government through the Army Corps of Engineers need to evaluate Enbridge's permits for crossing wetlands and waterways along the proposed reroute, and they need to complete environmental review. As I said, over the course of this time, Enbridge's submissions for its permit applications to cross those water bodies has been insufficient. Right now, those permits could not legally issue. In addition, we've called attention to the fact that the state's environmental review through its draft environmental impact statement is inadequate. Just one glaring example, that environmental review does not really quantify the harm caused by continuing to invest in fossil fuel infrastructure and the increased greenhouse gas emissions that will result if the project goes forward and Line 5 continues to operate past the 3-year deadline that the judge imposed. Those are costs to us and to future generations that really aren't quantifiable. But you know, if you do try to put a price on it, and we submitted information to the DNR as part of that process, we're talking about tens of billions of dollars in harm to future generations as a result of continuing to invest in fossil fuel infrastructure and creating situations where we're pumping more greenhouse gas into the atmosphere. So that's a whole set of environmental harms that we haven't really touched on yet this morning, but are part of the environmental review that needs to happen.
Tony, in our last 30 seconds together, what's your reaction to the fine? Around $5 million, is that enough? Is it appropriate?
You know, I agree with the chairman. It's not appropriate for a company like Enbridge. That's the cost of doing business, and it doesn't deter the illegal conduct, and it doesn't make up for the harm that Enbridge has caused the band in this instance. So it's not sufficient. I imagine that will also be part of the appeal moving forward.
I want to thank you both for joining us today. We will be keeping an eye on this case as it moves forward for certain. Mike Wiggins, chairman of the Bad River Band, and Tony Wilkin-Gibbert, director of Midwest Environmental Advocates. Appreciate you both. I'm Shereen Seward. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. Morning Show. I'm Shereen Seward in for Kate Archer-Kent. When Wisconsin residents hit hard times, some turn to local welfare offices for help. Those offices are outsourced to private for-profit companies where staff often preach the power of work, sometimes place people into unpaid work experience, and enforce work requirements in the name of teaching self-sufficiency. It's a multi-million dollar industry, and a new investigation is raising questions about who benefits the most. Call in 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Chrissy Clark is the host and senior correspondent of the documentary podcast The Uncertain Hour. The most recent investigation, the Welfare to Work Industrial Complex, focuses on work requirements for cash benefits and who profits in Wisconsin and nationally. Chrissy, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
Your latest investigation examined the relationship between work requirements, cash benefits, and profits in Wisconsin. So explain cash benefits in Wisconsin and what the work requirements are to receive them.
Yeah, so in Wisconsin, welfare or cash assistance is known as W-2 or Wisconsin Works. And just to step back for a minute, so across the country and in Wisconsin, the idea of work requirements in welfare, they're not necessarily really about having a paying job, even though a lot of the rhetoric around welfare reform is about the power of employment to lift people out of poverty. Most of the laws governing how work requirements work, they're not actually about employment. The only real metric that states are actually held accountable for around their use of welfare dollars is something called this work participation rate. And that's this sort of wonky mouthful of a term that basically means it measures how many people are receiving cash welfare or are doing some sort of work activity for a required number of hours. So a paying job will qualify, but if you don't have one of those yet, in Wisconsin, you're assigned to up to about 40 hours of these other work-related activities. So searching for jobs, taking motivational job readiness classes, or as you mentioned, doing unpaid work experience at a local nonprofit or for-profit business. There's also in limited amount of hours you can do in education, getting your GED or short-term vocational education training classes. And then you have to document each hour of work activity that you do with logs and timesheets in order to get your check. And if a state doesn't meet their target work participation rate, they can actually lose some of their federal funding. So what that means is that there's a lot of energy at the case level where case managers are focused on whether each individual participant on welfare is complying with the amount of hours that they've been assigned. Some people I've talked to who work in these programs have described it as sort of a compliance paperwork chasing machine. A lot of time is spent doing paperwork and data entry to make sure that participants are doing their required number of work activities. And if you don't meet the number of work activities you're supposed to be doing, you get $5 docked from your check for every hour that you don't participate in an assigned work activity. So that's kind of how it works at the broad level. And the issue is that there is not a lot of evidence that these work activities actually do much in terms of helping people get family sustaining jobs, which is the whole point of this. For a lot of people, it kind of feels like busy work, sort of more like a paperwork requirement than a work requirement. Some people do get a lot of, some people, you know, find benefits from it, but overall, there's not a lot of evidence showing that these programs are, these so-called welfare to work programs, are actually getting folks into family sustaining jobs that would allow them to not have to turn to welfare in the future.
Can you give me some examples of, where work requirements end up being problematic for some of these, some of the people that you spoke to? I mean, are they getting training in things that they wouldn't have gotten otherwise?
Yeah. So, you know, let me tell you about one woman that I followed for this story, this woman named Darnetta. So she had actually turned to welfare after fleeing domestic violence, had some very traumatic events. She had two kids. And so she had to leave her house in a frantic moment. So she really just, she'd kind of She needed help. She didn't have anywhere else to turn at that point. She did have a fair amount of work experience, a pretty solid resume. She had college credits. She was close to finishing her associate's degree. She had jobs before. She had clear goals. She wanted to be either an addiction counselor or open up her own restaurant. She says she wanted to work. She turned to welfare both for the immediate cash assistance, but also to sort of help. She had heard this is all about welfare to work, and she wanted some help in achieving her goals towards landing back on her feet and getting a job. When she brought her resume to her caseworker, what she was told is that she would be, her assigned work activity was going to be packing and stacking boxes in a food bank for up to 40 hours a week. And when she, and actually, if you did the math, she was going to be making about $653 check. That's a typical check in Wisconsin.
For a month.
Monthly
a,
check.
Okay.
Yeah, for a month. So mm-hmm. not a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
She, when you do that math, kind of divide the amount of work hours she was going to be doing into that check, that's making essentially about $4 an hour, less than minimum wage. So when she was told this is what she was going to be doing, she felt like, wait a minute, this is not, like, this is manual labor that is, like, I'm working towards my college degree. This, how is this going to help me in landing a job that is actually going to pay me a amount of money that allows me to support my family? She actually pushed back and asked for another job, and she was assigned office work instead. But she kept kind of, this was one of the first signs for her that maybe this was not a program that was going to be helping her get the kind of job that she needed. The work, she kept bumping into these sort of these constrictions around the work requirement program. If she was late to a work activity, if she didn't fill out a job log correctly, she would get sanctioned. She would get $5 per hour that she missed taken out of her check. Often she was getting like $20 to $100 taken out of her check, or maybe even $200 in a month. And when you're only getting $653, mm-hmm. that's not a lot. And what she found, meanwhile, she was, as I mentioned, she was sort of recovering from a series of domestic violence incidences. She was trying to go to therapy appointments and bring her family back together in the aftermath of this. And then that was kind of bumping up against these pretty the structure of the hours she was supposed to be at these various classes and work requirement assigned activities. So for her, that became a real problem. She felt like the program as it was set up wasn't helping her and was actually becoming kind of a stumbling block for her as she was trying to get her life back together.
We're talking about the privatization of the welfare state with Chrissy Clark. She's the host and senior correspondent of the documentary podcast, The Uncertain Hour. The most recent investigation focuses on work requirements for cash benefits in Wisconsin and who profits, both in Wisconsin and nationally. You spent years touring for-profit welfare offices, including in one in Milwaukee. Let's hear from that for-profit welfare company in Milwaukee now.
Look yourself in the eye, and with excitement and enthusiasm, say, I love my job because they pay me for working there.
So what is the atmosphere like in the for-profit offices, and how much money are they making for job readiness programs?
Yeah, you know, until I started this reporting, I did not realize that there was such a thing as these for-profit companies that were running welfare offices across Wisconsin and in places all over the country. And to be clear, there are also in Wisconsin some nonprofit companies that run some of the regional welfare offices. But for example, in Milwaukee, I think it's 3 out of the 4 offices are run by for-profit companies. The one that I visited was run by a very large company called Maximus, which is actually a multinational, multi-billion-dollar, publicly traded corporation based out of Virginia. And, you know, you go to the office, it's typical cubicles, fluorescent lighting, but a lot of motivational posters on the walls mm-hmm. about the power of work, as you heard, a lot of these motivational speeches. And the main focus in these offices is this idea of welfare to work, getting people into jobs and off of welfare. And so one of the first things that you might do when you apply for welfare and get enrolled is be assigned to take one of these motivational classes that the company offers for several hours a day. And you write down your goals and your dreams and learn how to maybe dress for a job, the importance of punctuality, learn about interviewing. And some folks I talked to, you know, they learned from these classes. They were helpful. But a lot of folks had already had jobs. The problem wasn't that they didn't know how to get a job or that they weren't motivated to get a job. The problem was often that the jobs did not pay enough to allow them to create any sort of safety net a personal safety net, so that when they hit hard times, they had, you know, they had the wherewithal mm-hmm. to make it through. And then when I talked to one of the designers of this class at Maximus, who's also a VP there, it was clear that sort of aside from the motivation, there was this other thing that was driving these programs. Because one of the things that the company does is they cultivate relationships with area businesses and then help sort of funnel and connect people to jobs in the area. These are often entry-level jobs, service jobs, warehouse work, sometimes in fast food. And what is important to understand about how this works is that for every job that one of these, or for every time a company like Maximus connects somebody on their welfare rolls with a job that lasts more than 31 days, as long as that job makes at least $800 and lasts for 31 days, the company gets a payment that's called a performance outcome payment. Mm-hmm. And it's often like $1,000 to $2,000. And
so that's how they also make money
by, you know, they're covered sort of just for the administration and enforcement of okay. work requirements, the monitoring, the case management, but the crucial part in terms of their profit are these performance outcome payments. And the question is, is getting somebody a job that might make them $800 a month, that's all it takes to qualify to get one of these payments, and that only lasts a month, is that actually setting them on a path to self-sufficiency and financial stability?
Chrissy
and it's
Clark,
not clear that it is.
Okay. Chrissy Clark is the host. We'll pick that up in just a minute. Chrissy Clark is the host and senior correspondent of Marketplace's The Uncertain Hour. She stays with us. You can call 2-800-642-1234. I'm Shereen Seward. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show. I'm Shereen Seward. Politicians for decades have debated whether people on the receiving end of entitlement programs should be required to work, look for work, or participate in job training programs as a condition for government aid.
Look for a job, get a job, all of that.
Should be required to work.
An obligation to work.
Looking for a job, have a job, or be participating in a job training program.
It's time for all Americans to get off of welfare and get back to work. You're going to love it.
That's in the introduction of a new podcast from Marketplace. So what are your thoughts on welfare reform proposals? Call in 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Chrissy Clark is the host and senior correspondent of the documentary podcast, The Uncertain Hour. She investigated work requirements for cash benefits and who profits in Wisconsin and nationally. She stays with us. Chrissy, something that you said a few minutes ago just keeps sticking with me. The amount of money that a for-profit agency gets for placing someone, it sounds like they're getting more money than the worker is getting.
It can, when you do the math, it can add up to that, or it can work out to that sometimes. For example, so Maximus, the company we were talking about earlier, there are several companies that have similar models. Maximus, America Works, Equus. But to take Maximus as an example, according to our analysis of state records, in the last 10 years, the state of Wisconsin has paid Maximus over about $7 million based on the kinds of performance outcome payments that I was talking about for people on welfare getting jobs and retaining those jobs for up to 3 months. And I actually looked at, sort of dove into one case in particular, this woman, Quanessa, who lives in Milwaukee. She turned to welfare soon after her second child was born. She didn't have stable housing. And she went through a Maximus welfare to work program. And, you know, she says that she got some things out of it. She felt more comfortable interviewing, and she ended up getting she did some of this unpaid work experience as a cleaning offices in a nonprofit. And she ended up getting a job as a custodian through a company that Maximus had connected her with. She ended up making about $13 to $14 an hour to begin with at that job. This was a few years ago. But when I dug into the story, you know, a couple things came out. One, it became clear that she'd actually already been doing cleaning work and had several jobs as a cleaner before she went through this welfare to work program. So it was a little unclear how much help Maximus's welfare to work program had given her versus whether she might have gotten that kind of job on her own. The other thing is, as you mentioned, if you compare the amount of money that Quanessa got through cash welfare in that time, it looks like, and then you compare the amount of money that Maximus got for connecting her with these jobs over, she cycled back onto welfare. She got off welfare through this job as a custodian, but then it turns out that job wasn't paying her enough that she could afford a car that worked very well. So when her car stopped working, she had to leave that job, and transportation is a huge issue for a lot of folks in terms of being able to get to where a job is. So then she went back on welfare. Maximus connected her with another job that also didn't pay a whole lot. And so she ended up having to work two jobs to make ends meet. So if you look at all of the rewards that this for-profit company got for connecting her with these various jobs, they made about as much money from the state and likely more if you do the math compared to the amount of cash assistance that Quanessa was getting in that time. And so that, you know, kind of raises these questions, especially given that the kinds of jobs Quanessa was getting weren't necessarily setting her up for success. They weren't paying her a whole lot. She was working really hard, but I think there's sort of this question of all this money that's going to incentivize these companies to get people into the workforce. Are they doing what we want them to do? Especially if a lot of folks already have had some job history and are ending up in these very low-paying jobs.
We're talking about the privatization of the welfare state with Chrissy Clark. She is host and senior correspondent of the documentary podcast The Uncertain Hour. The most recent investigation focuses on work requirements for cash benefits and who profits in Wisconsin and nationally. A couple minutes left. We will go to Mary Kay in Kenosha. Hi, Mary Kay. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, good morning. I was in the very first program in Kenosha. We had that here. It's a never-ending program of constantly going to programs. The assessors aren't in. They're never in. They're only in on certain days. You get sanctioned if your papers aren't signed. They go on vacation. So you're constantly going around in circles. The very first problem with the program is the jobs don't pay enough to live. You need at least $30,000 a year now to raise a family, okay? A part-time job is not really a job. It's part-time, okay? And there's no monitors for these programs. If we had monitors that would actually talk with the companies about transportation and childcare, because that's the real reason people can't get jobs. They can't get there. When those employers want you, they want you now, not when you want to go.
Thanks, Mary Kay. Yeah, and what do these companies do to help with transportation? Is there any of that component involved in the process?
Yeah, you know, there are transportation vouchers and some transportation assistance that the companies connect people with, funding that comes from the state or from these federal block grants for welfare. So there is some assistance that is offered, but I think that the experience that Mary Kay is referencing is quite common. And as I mentioned, this woman, Quanessa, you know, once you get off the once you sort of graduate out of the program and you have a job, if it isn't a job, if it's only paying you, I think the average wage for jobs that welfare participants, people on cash welfare, W-2, got in Wisconsin was about $11 an hour. So that's not enough, you know, that's not enough money to support a family on, let alone an individual. So transportation does become a real issue. One thing I did want to point out is that I spoke extensively to folks at the state about some of the issues, and they were very candid about the fact that they know that a lot of these programs are often connecting people with low-paying work. They know that that's an issue. They know that people are then sometimes cycling back onto welfare because when they hit another stumbling block, they don't have the financial safety net to mm-hmm. not turn to it. And they've actually entered into a contract to have the program evaluated that's going on right now that they are hoping to be completed before the next contract start in 2025. So there is some awareness at the level of the state administration that maybe, you know, this program that's been around now since 1996, it hasn't had a formal look in terms of sort of what could be done. And I think that there are efforts to start to reevaluate that.
Thank you so much. Chrissy Clark, the host and senior correspondent of the documentary podcast, The Uncertain Hour. The most recent investigation focuses on work requirements for cash benefits and who profits. We have a link to The Uncertain Hour at WPR.org/mornings. I'm Shereen Seward. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Idea Network.